have to look at its contextual partner, chamer, to take us one direction or another. The verb, chamer, is used in the contexts of the Levitical responsibility of guarding sacred space, as well as in the sense of observing religious commands and responsibilities. This verb is only used in agricultural contexts when crops are being guarded from those people or animals who would destroy or steal. When the verb applies to Levitical activity, it could involve control of access to the sacred precinct, although it is often applied more generally to performing duties on the grounds. To conclude, then, I would propose the following line of logic. Since there are a couple of contexts in which shemer is used for Levitical service along with be'ad, for example, Numbers chapter 3, verses 8 to 9, and 1. The contextual use of shemer here favors sacred service, and be'ad is as likely to refer to sacred service as to agricultural tasks. And, 2. There are other indications that the garden is being portrayed as sacred space. Then, it is likely that the tasks given to Adam are of a priestly nature, caring for sacred space. In ancient thinking, caring for sacred space was a way of uploading creation. By preserving order, non-order was held at bay. As J. Martin Plumley describes it in Egyptian thinking, so it was throughout the ancient world, including Israel at many points. But, whatever wise men might think about the purpose of creation, and whatever might be the official doctrines about the way in which the creation came into being, there was the universal belief that what had been achieved in the beginning of time must be maintained. For mortal men, the most essential task of earthly life was to ensure that the fabric of the universe was sustained. The ancient cosmogonies were in agreement that obscure forces of chaos had existed before the world was created, and that, although in the act of creation they had been cast away to the outer edges of the world, they nevertheless continued to threaten to encroach into the world. The possibility of such a catastrophe could only be averted by the actions of gods and men, both working together to maintain the world order. That order which embraced the notions of an equilibrium of the universe, the harmonious coexistence of all its elements, and its essential cohesion for the maintenance of all created forms, was summed up in the word me'at. If the priestly vocabulary in Genesis chapter 2, verse 15, indicates the same kind of thinking, the point of caring for sacred space should be seen as much more than landscaping, or even priestly duties. Maintaining order made one a participant with God in the ongoing task of sustaining the equilibrium God had established in the cosmos. Egyptian thinking attached this not only to the role of priests as they maintained the sacred space in the temples, but also to the king, whose task was to complete what was unfinished and to preserve the existent, not in a status quo, but in a continuing, dynamic, even revolutionary process of remodeling and improvement. This combines the subduing and ruling of Genesis chapter 1 with the be'ad and shamir of this chapter. Having said all of that, once we have identified the primary role as a priestly one in sacred space, we may find that we can fold other caretaking tasks back into the priestly profile. When garden parks are associated with sacred space in the ancient world, caring for the trees in the park is a sacred task performed by priests. In Egypt and Mesopotamia, there would likewise be herds and flocks of animals that were the property of the temple and would be cared for by priests. When priests take care of garden parks and animals associated with the parks, they are engaged in ordering sacred space and in subduing and ruling. On that basis of this priestly understanding of the verbs that describe Adam's commissioning, I would conclude that the specific point that Genesis chapter 2 contributes to the book is not in relation to Adam's unique material origins, or to human origins in general, but rather to Adam's elect role in sacred space. This is not a new idea. In early interpretation, the Book of Jubilees presents Adam as offering incense when he leaves Eden, thereby supporting both the priestly role of Adam and the identification of Eden as sacred space. In early Christian interpretation, Origen portrays Adam as high priest. In the account of his origins, Adam served as an archetype with all humanity represented in him. In his priestly role, he serves as a representational agent, serving on behalf of humanity. All humans are represented by him. Adam's role must then be understood in light of the role of the priests in the ancient world. When we read the Bible, we often think of priests as ritual experts, and as those instructing the people in the ways of the Lord and the law. That is true, but those tasks fit into a larger picture. The main task of the priest was the preservation of sacred space. They preserved sacred space by instructing people regarding what sacred space requires of them, purity standards for each zone of sacred space, behavior appropriate to sacred space, so that its sanctity can be maintained. Offering sacrifices in the appropriate ways at the appropriate times and with appropriate gifts so that sanctity will be preserved. Guarding sacred space and the sacred objects found therein so that their sanctity is preserved. Keeping out anything that would compromise or corrupt the sanctity of sacred space. Serving as mediators who make the benefits of sacred space available to the people, thereby extending sacred space, and who assure that the gifts of the people get to God. Sacred space exists because of the manifest presence of God. Adam was given access to this sacred space as a priest in order to be involved in preserving its sanctity and mediating its benefits. Sacred space was also the center of order because order emanates from God. The idea that people would subdue and rule is based on the idea that they would have a continuing role as God's vice-regents, in His image, to preserve order and to extend it under God. He is given access to the tree of life, but the tree of wisdom is withheld, presumably pending a process of mentoring by God. We may discuss which of the roles in the list would be necessary for Adam to do in Eden, but regardless of the conclusions we might draw, we can understand that the listening or reading Israelite audience would have thought of these sorts of activities when the text speaks of Adam's priestly roles. This was a huge task, and God therefore observes that it is not good for man to be alone. This does not suggest that no other people exist, only that Adam alone had been given the task of carrying out this commission in sacred space, formed for the role as discussed in connection to that verb. Neither should we assume that the comment has to do with loneliness versus companionship and the psychological need for a soul partner. Likewise, we cannot import the idea resident in the statement of the blessing of the last chapter, and conclude that Adam is in need of a reproduction partner. That is not under discussion in Genesis chapter 2, and he would not be looking among the animals to resolve this. Rather, God is stating that the task is too large for him to do on his own. He needs an ally to help him in sacred space. Because of the nature of the task of serving in sacred space, the only appropriate ally would be one that is Adam's ontological equal. One of the potentially confusing elements in the text is how the animals fit into what the text is conveying. They would have little connection to the concept of sacred space or priestly roles. In light of the position I am proposing, God brings the animals to Adam, and as he reflects on their roles and functions and names them, he finds that none of them is his ontological equal. God then shows Adam in a vision that woman is his ontological equal, and when he awakes, she is brought to him, and he recognizes that fact. Bone of my bone, and flesh of my flesh, she is comparable to man. The text then explains that because of this ontological pairing, man will routinely leave the close biological relationship with parents to reforge what is an ontologically rooted relationship. Genesis chapter 2, verse 24. We might note in passing that in the Gilgamesh epic, Enkidu also discovers that woman, not animals, is his ontological equal. Enkidu, a primitive man, was created individually by the gods from clay and full-grown, inhabiting the wild, unclothed, and keeping company with animals. Chapter 1, verses 99 through 112. He eventually finds a woman as his companion. She seduces him, and learns that he cannot continue to enjoy companionship among the animals. He is not a beast of the wild. In this sense, the scene in Genesis chapter 2 indicates that Adam is not Enkidu. He finds no companion among the animals, but, like Enkidu, he learns that he is not a beast. Many of the elements in Genesis chapters 2 to 3 find points of contact in the descriptions of Enkidu in the Gilgamesh epic, but none of them works the same. In this way, we could say that Genesis chapters 2 to 3 is engaged in discussing some of the same topics as the Gilgamesh epic, but stands in juxtaposition to it at nearly every point. At one level, then, it is no surprise that Genesis chapter 2 brings up man's relationships with the animals for discussion. In the Gilgamesh epic, the woman, Shamhat, seduces Enkidu with the result that he becomes civilized. Though the mechanism was sexual experience, the focus was the civilizing of a wild man. He gains reason and understanding. Chapter 1, verse 202, and Shamhat then leads him to sacred space. Chapter 1, verses 209 to 210. In Genesis, the awareness of woman as a companion and ally comes first, and the sexual experience is constant re-establishment of an ontological whole. Again, Genesis turns the discussion upside down. Genesis is thus using common literary motifs to convey the truths about humanity that are the familiar topics of the conversation in the ancient world. They are operating in the same room of discourse, but Genesis has rearranged all the furniture. Adam shows some similarity to Enkidu, and in other parts of the epic, even to Gilgamesh himself. But he is very different from both of them, and is usually portrayed in sharp contradistinction. In this way, Genesis chapters 2 to 3 may be seen as making cultural allusions. In class, when I make a cultural allusion, its significance is lost if the class is not familiar with the movie, song, or video game to which I am alluding. The line becomes a source of confusion to them because they are unaware of the connection I am referencing. Likewise, if Genesis is making allusions to the literary world of the ancient Near East, as observable in literature such as the Gilgamesh epic, and we, as an audience, have no knowledge of that literary world, we will miss the significance of the allusion. Through the account in Genesis chapter 2, it is shown that woman was not just another creature, but was like the man, in fact, his other half, sharing his nature, and was therefore suitable as his ally. She joined him as guardian and mediator with the task of preserving, protecting, and expanding sacred space. It was not unusual in the ancient world for women to serve in priestly roles, despite the recognized hazard of their monthly impurity. Israel, however, was an exception to this, as only men served as priests. It may seem odd, therefore, that Genesis chapter 2 presents a woman as a co-laborer within sacred space along with the man, especially if the narrative scenario is an Israelite authority figure, such as Moses, talking to an Israelite audience. The priestesses in the ancient world were sometimes involved as administrators of sacred space, but these roles are seen mostly in the late 3rd and early 2nd millennia B.C. In the Bible, we do find women serving in sacred space. Exodus chapter 38, verse 8. 1 Samuel chapter 2, verse 22, though not as priestesses, and there are differences of opinions about what their role was. In the ancient world, sexual or magical roles were more associated with women serving in sacred space as time went on. To the extent that such was the case, Israelite practice may have featured only men in priestly roles in order to establish a distinction between themselves and their neighbors and to keep sexual rituals out of the sacred precinct. Whatever explanations may be found, they are not sufficient to discount the idea that in Genesis chapter 2, the woman is seen as the ally to man in service, in sacred space. As an ally, she would not have to have the same roles as man, but little more can be said given the lack of information provided in the text. The text comments only on her ontological identity as man's other half, rather than delineating her role in sacred space. Returning to the priestly roles of Adam and Eve, we will gain more insight if we look to the larger paradigm offered by the identification of Israel as a kingdom of priests. Exodus chapter 19, verse 6. The very context of communication about constructing sacred space, the tabernacle at Sinai. Israel's priestly role is found neither in the offering of rituals on behalf of the rest of the nations, nor in servicing sacred space for them. Their role is to mediate knowledge of God, and their end goal is ultimately not to restrict access to the presence of God, but to mediate access through instruction. The role of Adam and Eve in the garden, I would propose, has less to do with how the priests operated within Israel, and more to do with Israel's role, and later, that of believers, 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 9, as priests to the world. In such a view, we need not be concerned about the lack of women priests in Israel. We previously spoke of Adam and Eve as archetypal representatives. Here, we find that they are also priestly representatives. These two types of representation should be distinguished from each other. In the first, their individuality is submerged in their archetypal significance. In the second, they serve as individuals on behalf of a group, as priests always did. In that priestly role, they are mediators, and their actions have implications and at times real impact on the entire group they represent. Before concluding this chapter, it is relevant to remark on an anecdotally parallel passage in the Gilgamesh epic that could shed light on Genesis chapter 2. In Tablet 11, the flood hero, Utnapishti, disembarks from the ark to be met by a group of the gods discussing how he was spared, whether he should have been spared, and what they were to do with him now. In lines 203 to 206, the decision is made and a blessing conferred. In the past, Utnapishti was one of mankind, but now Utnapishti and his woman shall be like us gods. Utnapishti shall dwell far away at the mouth of the rivers. They took me and settled me far away at the mouth of the rivers. The setting to which the flood hero is taken is an Edenic setting, at the mouth of the rivers, where he will have an existence like the gods. It is not a dwelling with the gods, but it is removed from the strictly mortal realm. Note that Gilgamesh had to cross the ocean and the waters of death to get there. Utnapishti's being taken is seen as a blessing. This sort of understanding would also make sense for Enoch in Genesis chapter 5, where the same verb is used. Not only is Adam taken, as Utnapishti is, Genesis chapter 2, verse 15, he is also situated at the source of the rivers, Genesis chapter 2, verse 10. In Gilgamesh, Utnapishti is settled there, whereas the word used for the placement of Adam is even more significant, since it is the causative form of the verb to rest, lanuach. In God's presence, Adam finds rest, an important allusion to what characterizes sacred space. Both Adam and Utnapishti are placed in sacred space, where they have access to life. Despite these similarities, we must not neglect the significant differences. Though both Adam and Utnapishti are in sacred space, Adam is there in a special relationship with God. In contrast, Utnapishti's situation has no connection to the realm of the gods, nor does it anticipate relationship with them. Adam and Eve become like the gods when they seize wisdom for themselves. Utnapishti's becoming like the gods is a promotion, a boon, granted to him. Utnapishti is unique, not archetypal or priestly in any way. No particular role for him is identified. Unlike Adam and Eve, Utnapishti and his wife are neither guardians nor mediators of sacred space. They are simply privileged denizens. The benefit of comparing Genesis chapter 5 and Gilgamesh tablet 11 is the understanding that Adam, the archetypal human, is being removed from the everyday realm of human existence and placed in a specially prepared place, the source of the rivers, as a blessing with access to life. Interestingly, Utnapishti's name refers to him as one who found life, and in finding Eve, Adam has found the mother of all the living, Genesis chapter 3, verse 20, as he names her. In conclusion, rather than understanding Scripture as necessitating the view that Adam and Eve are the first humans, in light of their specific role concerned with access to God in sacred space and relationship with Him, we might alternatively consider the possibility that they are the first significant humans. As with Abram, who was given a significant role as the ancestor of Israel, though not the first ancestor of Israel, Adam and Eve would be viewed as established as significant by their election. This would be true whether or not other people were around. Their election is to a priestly role, the first to be placed in a sacred space. The forming accounts give them insight into the nature of humanity, but they also become the first significant humans because of their role in bringing sin into the world. Adam was the first man given the opportunity to bring life, but he failed to achieve that goal. Christ, as the last man, succeeded as he provided life and access to the presence of God for all, as our great high priest. The role of Adam and Eve as priests in sacred space is what sets them apart, not their genetic role. If Genesis chapter 1 features the inauguration of sacred space and God taking up his rest, the presence of a center of that sacred space, for example, a temple, is implied. If the Garden of Eden serves that temple function, then Genesis chapter 2 must be viewed as taking place in the same general time, though it can come after the 7 days rather than within it. In such a scenario, Adam and Eve should likely be considered part of that initial human creation in Genesis chapter 1, though since only corporate humanity is mentioned, the text does not explicitly rule out the idea that there were others. According to my analysis of the Toledot account, I would suggest that Genesis chapter 2 is not recursively recounting what happened on day 6, but is talking about what happened in the aftermath of day 6. Proposition 13. The garden is an ancient Near Eastern motif for sacred space, and the trees are related to God as the source of life and wisdom. Issues that need to be addressed in this chapter include the literary nature of the text, the theological significance of the chapter, and the ancient Near Eastern background that gives it shape. In the process, we need to discuss the two central trees and the question of the nature and location of the garden. From the start, it is important to recognize that the garden, the trees, and the serpent are symbols. By that, I do not mean to suggest that they are not real. We must simply recognize that they stand for something beyond themselves. That symbolized reality is transcendent and far more important than the physical realities, however one might assess the latter. Garden of Eden. When we consider the Garden of Eden in its ancient context, we find that it is more sacred space than green space. It is the center of order, not perfection, and its significance has more to do with divine presence than human paradise. In the textual description, it features rivers that bring fertility and an arboretum of sorts. This park-like environment is well known in the ancient world. The motif of flowing rivers, 4 is common, is connected to sacred space early and often. The same motif can be seen in Ezekiel chapter 47, and there are allusions to it throughout the Psalms and the prophets. Gardens were constructed adjoining sacred space as evidence of the fertility that resulted from the presence of God. They were not vegetable gardens or fields of crops. They were beautifully landscaped parks. They provided fruit that was offered to the gods. Kings also built gardens, adjoining their own palaces, where they would receive and impress visitors. Thus, the text of Genesis can be seen to describe a garden, a park landscaped with exotic trees and stocked with wildlife. These were common accoutrements to temples and palaces in the ancient world. I suggested that in Genesis chapter 1, the cosmos was being designated as sacred space, but no information was given there about where the center of sacred space was located, though it was designed to function on behalf of people. In Genesis chapter 2, the center of sacred space is located for us, and people are placed there. If Eden is the center of sacred space, it bears some resemblance to the Holy of Holies in the tabernacle/temple. We are not surprised, then, that scholars have long recognized Eden's symbolism in the temple. Elizabeth Block Smith refers to the temple as a virtual Garden of Eden. Victor Hurwitz similarly concludes, the decorations in the temple and their distribution were significant and logical. It seems as if the temple was not merely Yahweh's residence, but a divine garden on earth. This interpretation of Eden is found in the earliest interpretation outside the Bible, the Book of Jubilees, 2nd century B.C., though it is subtle. In the interpretation of Jubilees, Adam and Eve have relations right after Eve is brought to Adam, and at that time, they are outside the garden. Then they have to purify themselves before entering the garden, which then, by implication, is considered sacred space. Among early Christian interpreters, Ephrem, 4th century, gave extensive treatment to the ways in which the Garden of Eden was similar to the tabernacle. Iconography amply supports this relationship between garden/rivers and temples, but most of the archaeological evidence relates to palaces rather than temples. It is no surprise that kings replicated for themselves the perquisites that gods enjoyed. Archaeologists have discovered a temple near Asur, with many rows of tree pits in the courtyard. In Egypt, a divine grove at times was associated with a temple. Artificial pools, exotic trees and plants, fish and waterfowl, and produce grown for the provision of the gods were all features of these temple gardens. Their fertility and ordered arrangements symbolized order in the cosmos. Besides the iconographical and archaeological data, texts inform our understanding of the Garden of Eden. Even though there is no precedent in the ancient Near Eastern literature that would serve as a parallel to the full profile of Genesis chapter 2, there are a number of texts that touch on various parts of it. I referred to a number of the associations with the Gilgamesh epic in the last chapter. There is no paradise myth in the Gilgamesh epic, or in the following pieces that we will examine. In fact, there is no paradise myth in any of our extant ancient Near Eastern literature. Nevertheless, we find some of the motifs that are familiar to us from Genesis chapters 2 to 3, although they are in a very different sort of context. Enki and Ninharsag, Dilmun. Among the features that this myth shares with Genesis is that the setting is described in not-yet terms, as is also found in Genesis chapter 2, verses 5 to 6. The land of Dilmun is described in terms of the absence of normal behavior at various levels, lines 11 to 28. In the animal world, birds were not making their sounds. Predators were not killing for their food, but neither were other animals aware of what they should eat. Pigs did not know of grain. Other habitual animal behaviors pertaining to caring for young or sleeping were not yet practiced. There were no diseases, and no one was growing old. There was no darkness. Human behaviors had likewise not been initiated. No heralds, no mourning. Dilmun, located at the mouth of the waters, is the place to which Utnapishti was taken in the Gilgamesh epic. It is of a place of cultic purity, and in that sense it is sacred space, though it is not being set up as such in this myth. It is already that. Differences include the absence of the concept of a garden of God for human and divine interaction. There is a garden in the myth, featuring a number of trees, which the god Enki identifies. He decrees their destinies as he eats from them. Ninharsag curses Enki because she had planted the trees. So, there is a garden on Dilmun, but Dilmun itself is not a garden. Furthermore, this garden is neither a site of divine human interaction nor a place for human dwelling. Dilmun is certainly not a paradise, but an inchoate scenario in which destinies have not yet been decreed. Order has not yet been established. As the myth closes, Ninharsag is asking Enki what parts of him hurt. He identifies several: head, hair, nose, mouth, throat, arm, ribs, and sides. And for each one, Ninharsag gives birth to a deity, and each of them is then assigned a different role. Scholars have paid particular attention to the one given birth because Enki's ribs hurt. Ninti, Lady of the Ribs. When roles are assigned, Ninti is identified as Lady of the Month. The context, however, shows that there is no parallel here of any sort. All the characters are gods, not humans. Ninti is only one in a series of deities associated with various parts of the body, and the goddesses are given birth, not formed. Ninti has no continuing association with Enki. This is not even close enough to be considered a parallel motif. We find that this myth provides us very little for evaluating or understanding Genesis chapters 2 to 3. The inclusion of rib is incidental. Jewel Garden of Gilgamesh. In the Neo-Assyrian version of the Gilgamesh epic, Gilgamesh encounters a jewel garden near the end of his quest for Utnapishti, the Babylonian flood hero. It is located where Shamash, the sun god, enters and exits each day. Scholars are divided about whether the jewels metaphorically refer to fruit or whether the trees actually grow jewels. While there is no indication of divine presence and no prohibitions of trespass, the motif of jewels in the Garden of God is found in Ezekiel chapter 28. Trees and fruit. We now turn our attention specifically to the trees in the garden and that which they confer. Despite some general points of contact, no direct parallel exists in the ancient world for the two special trees in the center of the garden, the tree of life and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, equals tree of wisdom. First, we will summarize what information does exist in the ancient world and then proceed to a discussion of the biblical material. Adapa. In the tale of Adapa, we find the main character playing an archetypal role, as has been suggested for Adam and Eve. Here, however, the archetype does not concern human origins and nature, but particular human roles. Adapa was one of the first antediluvian sages, the Apkalus, of whom there were seven, and the most famous. These beings were storied as having emerged from the sea and were credited with teaching the arts of civilization. This character is known as late as the Hellenistic compilation of traditions by the Babylonian priest Berossus. In the tale known as Adapa and the South Wind, Adapa has an encounter with Anu in heaven, where he is offered food of life and water of life. He has been warned by another god, Ea, for whom he is a priest, that this offer is insincere and accepting it will bring his doom. But in that warning he has been deceived, and by declining the offer he, and apparently all of humanity with him, actually loses the chance for eternal life. The text of the Adapa tale is not clear on this issue, but one factor that would suggest that all of humanity is affected by Adapa's choice is Anu's exclamation, "Alas, for inferior humanity," after Adapa refuses the food. The most important element of the tale of Adapa for our study of Genesis chapters 2-3 is that, by virtue of his priestly position, his actions have ramifications for all of humanity. In a further comparison to Adam, Adapa is perhaps the most famous of the ancient sages, so he already has wisdom. He nevertheless lacks immortality. In contrast, Adam and Eve in Genesis have access to immortality, tree of life, but lack wisdom, associated with the forbidden tree of the knowledge of good and evil. We find that Genesis is interested in the same issues as the tale of Adapa, and both of them discuss these issues in terms of representatives of humanity. This is no reason to think that the literary pieces are related in any way, or that one is derivative from another. It simply shows us how Genesis is presenting its material in the context of the conversations that occurred in the second millennium B.C. Cosmic Tree in Eridu. In a Neo-Assyrian text from Ashurbanipal's library that features interlinear text in Sumerian and Akkadian, Cuneiform Texts, Volume 16, Plate 46, we encounter a number of motifs that are familiar from Genesis chapters 2-3, as is immediately evident from this translation of the pertinent lines. In Eridu grows the dark Gishkin tree, shining a pure place. Line 183. Its brilliance is that of lapis lazuli. It rises from the underground water, Apsu. Line 185. When Enki walks about Eridu, it is filled with abundance. Line 187. Its foundation is the opening of the underworld. Line 189. Its bed is the sanctuary of Nammu. Line 191. From its pure temple, a grove where no one enters, the dark tree rises. Line 193. Inside are the gods, Shamash and Tammuz. Line 195. At the mouth, / confluence of two rivers. Line 197. The Gishkin tree here is not a tree whose fruit has special qualities, but a cosmic tree, an important feature of cosmology in the ancient cultures. As can be understood here, it has its roots in the netherworld. It is associated with fertile waters, and it is located in a grove associated with a temple housing Shamash, sun god, and Tammuz, netherworld deity. It binds together heaven, earth, and the netherworld. Description of this tree can also be seen in Ezekiel chapter 31, where it is compared to the trees of Eden. We can therefore notice that the cosmic tree motif has some overlap with the trees in Genesis chapters 2 to 3. Ancient Near Eastern literature has no obvious parallel to a tree of wisdom, but scholars speak often of a tree of life motif. Before turning to that, we should note the plant of life, named plant of the heartbeat and designated old man becomes young, that Gilgamesh plucks from the Apsu, subterranean waters in the cosmological realm of the god Ea. Unfortunately, the plant was subsequently stolen by a serpent. It is also a plant of life that sustains Lugalbanda when he has been abandoned by friends in the wilderness because of his sickness. We have already noted the food of life, Agalbalati, here not specifically a plant, that is offered to Adapa. These three examples have in common that something is ingested that leads to the enhancement of life in some way, respectively, rejuvenation, healing sustenance, and immortality. Even though the details vary, the conversation provided by Genesis chapters 2 to 3 is similar. Ingestion is the mode, and enhanced life, unspecified though presumably immortality as inferred from Genesis chapter 3 verse 22, is the objective. The concerns represented in the texts are similar, as are the direction taken by the answers. But the literary contexts vary, as do the beliefs and assertions that emerge. Yet, we find that it makes sense against the backdrop of the ancient world for the Israelites to formulate the literature the way that they do. Besides these literary occurrences of the motif, something that one eats to gain life, much has been made of the iconography, especially from the Neo-Assyrian period, of what is commonly referred to as the Tree of Life, or preferably, the Sacred Tree. The motif of a sacred tree occurs throughout the ancient Near East across the spectrum of both time and culture. When the tree can be identified botanically, it is typically either a pomegranate or date palm. It is often flanked by winged genies in Assyria, or some variety of caprids in the Levant. A winged disc, at times, appears over the tree. In the Assyrian motif, the genies on either side are often thought to be holding date palm flower clusters for the purpose of pollination, and thus represent fertility. The tree itself is generally understood to represent a god or the king. For the latter, note Daniel chapter 4 and Zechariah chapter 4. No ancient Near Eastern texts offer explanation of the symbolism. If art historians, however, are on the right track, the tree represents order more than life, seen in the cosmic tree motif that we do know of in the ancient literature, and would therefore be more comparable in its properties to the tree of wisdom in the garden. given the close association of wisdom and order throughout the Old Testament and the ancient world. The Neo-Assyrian flanked tree, and its antecedent and subsequent versions, seems often to have figured in imagery of the world order as maintained by some deity. Such symbolism seems to be derivative from the tree as a symbol of cosmic well-being and of the good life in general. The properties of this sacred tree make it the source of wisdom and order rather than the source of life. Simo Parpola suggests that the tree can represent man as a microcosm, the ideal man created in the image of God. Genesis, chapters 2-3. As we found in the previous discussion of the Tale of Adapar, comparison with cuneiform texts, volume 16, plate 46, shows that the motifs and themes used in Genesis chapters 2-3 are hardly arbitrary. Instead, the story includes concepts familiar to people in the ancient world. In light of this observation, we have to keep in mind that Genesis chapters 2-3 is the form that the account took in Israelite traditions. The inspired storyteller is speaking to Israel and is prompted by the Spirit to use imagery that would communicate clearly in that world, dealing with issues that were current in that society. We do not have an account that is portrayed as being conveyed to Adam and Eve. It is an account about Adam and Eve being conveyed to Israelites. If it were given to Adam and Eve, we could not meaningfully talk about ancient Near Eastern backgrounds, since Adam and Eve did not have such a background. In this Israelite telling, however, it is clear that the broader cognitive environment of which ancient Israel is a part is reflected in the shaping of the account: sacred garden, special trees, involvement of serpent, concerns about wisdom and immortality. Even though the Israelite account is characterized by deep differences and has points to make that are unique in the ancient world. In Genesis, the trees are understood best in the context of sacred space rather than as isolated trees that happen to be in a garden. Whether interpreters consider them real, physical, floral specimens with the ability to bestow benefits to those who partake, figurative symbols of divine gifts, mythological motifs, or anything else, we must not miss the theological and textual significance that they have. Whether they confer or represent, they provide what is only God's to give. He is the source of life, which is given by Him and found in His presence. Deuteronomy chapter 30, verses 11-20. He is the center of order, and wisdom is the ability to discern order. Relationship with God is the beginning of wisdom. Job chapter 28, verse 28, and Proverbs chapter 1, verse 7. Consequently, we make a mistake to think that this is simply about magical trees in a garden paradise. It is about the presence of God on earth and what relationship with Him makes available. At one level, we can simply say they are whatever the Bible considers them to be, even if we cannot decide for certain, because whether they are literal or not, we know their significance. In this way, we commit to taking the Bible seriously and fulfilling the demands of our commitment to the truthfulness of Scripture. If the text chooses to use metaphorical symbols, it is free to do so, and we would be remiss to understand them any other way. Alternatively, if God chose to endow fruit trees with the wherewithal to confer the life and wisdom that comes from Him, we cannot say that it is impossible. God chose Samson's hair to provide him with strength. But strength came from God, not from hair. Whether the trees are literal or figurative, the basic point remains. Life is gained in the presence of God, and wisdom is His gift, not to be taken on one's own. God is the source and center of wisdom, not us. Regardless of our literary interpretation, the theology must be maintained. Life and wisdom are the gifts of God, and human representatives incurred guilt for all of us by grasping the latter illegitimately, and therefore losing the former. As discussed in Chapter 11, I believe that the biblical material makes the most sense when sin's entry is seen as punctiliar rather than the result of a gradual process. Conclusions. As we step back to draw some conclusions from this chapter, we have to discuss whether Eden, in Genesis chapters 2 to 3, is central or peripheral in the cosmos. In the ancient Near East, both Dilmun and the Jewel Garden in Gilgamesh are peripheral. In contrast, the sacred tree imagery presents a cosmic tree that is central. This sacred tree is symbolic of divine presence, according to Parpola, whereas none of the peripheral garden possibilities in the ancient Near East is a place of divine presence. The central garden that contains the sacred tree in Cuneiform Texts, Volume 16, Plate 46, does feature the presence of gods. When the fertile waters are thought of as sources, they are located in the center. The mouth of waters motif, for example, Dilmun, is peripheral. From this information, we might conclude that a central location would be identified as sacred space, whereas a peripheral location would be more appropriately labeled numinous space. In the Bible, evidences of centrality would include the use in Ezekiel, as it seems associated with the mountain of God and a cosmic tree, as well as the location in Genesis at the source of the rivers. Yet, in Genesis, there is no indication that the trees are considered cosmic trees. The fact that Adam and Eve are sent out of the garden and dwell to the east also suggests centrality, because when the garden is peripheral, it is as far to the east as one can go. Evidences that the Genesis garden should be considered peripheral are fewer. Aside from the comment that Adam was taken and settled in the garden, the same wording used for the peripheral relocation of Utnapishti, there is not much support. Two of the four rivers named in Genesis chapter 2 are real rivers in the real world. It is true that the few gardens featured in the mythology of the ancient world are peripheral, but the differences that we have noted between them and the Garden of Eden make that insufficient to construe Eden in the same way. Evidence heavily favors the central location of the Garden of Eden. The presence of God, the source of the rivers, known rivers at that, and the possibility that the tree of wisdom is comparable to the cosmic tree, all argue for its centrality. If God is the center, then humans are driven out to the liminal/periphery, instead of humans being at the center and the divine/numinal realm on the periphery. Yet even as we understand the case for Eden's centrality, we recognize a sense in which it is removed from easy access, if not numinously peripheral. As noted, two of the rivers are known rivers, but their sources are at the edges of the known world, a region eventually known as Urartu, where the mountains of Ararat in the flood narrative are located as well. Though the Tigris and Euphrates are well known, the identities of the Gihon and Pishon have long been debated. One well-supported theory now identifies the Pishon as the Halys River that flows from the region of Urartu around central Asia Minor and into the Black Sea. In this theory, the Gihon is identified as the Aras River, flowing eastward from Urartu and into the Caspian Sea. This would place the Garden of Eden in a high mountain valley near Lake Van, and thus explain how Eden is sometimes viewed as being on a mountain. This region was populated by the early Hurrians, some of whom eventually settled in Canaan and were encountered by the Israelites and their ancestors. The cosmic center can still be located in this remote region far removed from Israel. We therefore might conclude that the garden is considered cosmically central, though at the outskirts of the known world. In the ancient Near East, life and wisdom are the prerogatives of the gods that they are reluctant to grant as they try to maintain distance between themselves and humanity. In the Bible, life and wisdom are possessed by God, and they are made available to humans as they are in relationship to Him. The trouble comes when humans try to seize wisdom on their own terms. They are told that the fruit will make them like God. But unfortunately, this is as independent agents rather than in relationship to Him. In this way, the Bible has a very different read on these issues than its ancient Near Eastern counterparts. Proposition 14. The serpent would have been viewed as a chaos creature from the non-ordered realm, promoting disorder. Christian interpreters of Genesis have at times been confused by the serpent. Why did God allow such a creature to infiltrate the garden? How could this creature be in a good world? Based on New Testament references, the serpent is easily identified as Satan. Romans chapter 16, verse 20. Revelations chapter 12, verse 9, and chapter 20, verse 2. Raising questions about where he came from and what he is doing in this account. If we are going to understand Genesis as an ancient document, however, we have to understand the text first in ancient terms. That means that we cannot immediately jump to the eventual conclusion that the serpent is associated with Satan, for there is no indication that the serpent was so identified during the Old Testament times. Before considering the implications of later biblical interpretation, we should understand the ancient text on its own terms. Furthermore, we cannot interpret the text as if it is communicating in the world of Adam and Eve's knowledge because, as mentioned in previous chapters, we have an Israelite storyteller communicating to an Israelite audience. That audience would have made certain associations with the serpent imagery that are not necessarily natural to us. Serpent symbolism was rich in the ancient Near East. We have already made reference to the serpent who stole the plant of life from Gilgamesh, but that is only the beginning. We have discussed the tale of Adapah, but have not yet referred to the serpent figure there. In that narrative, the serpent is not involved in any temptation and is not a main character. When Adapah responds to Anu's invitation to meet with him, one of the guardians of Anu's palace is Gizida, equals Ningishzida, lord of the productive tree, who has the shape of a serpent and is accompanied by horned serpents, Basmu. He is known as the guardian of demons who live in the netherworld. In Egypt, we find serpents everywhere from the crown of Pharaoh to pictures on painted sarcophagi, as well as in the Book of the Dead, as deadly enemies along the path to the afterlife. These creatures are associated with both wisdom and death. Apophis was a serpent of chaos who tried to swallow the sun as it rose every morning. Other elements can be found in the Egyptian Book of the Dead that connect to ideas that are evident in the Genesis account, including crawling on the belly, eating dust, a crushing head, and striking a heel. The following entries drawn from the Zondervan Illustrated Bible Backgrounds Commentary, Old Testament, address some of the details in Genesis. Crawl on your belly, chapter 3, verse 14. The Egyptian pyramid texts were designed to aid the pharaohs of the Old Kingdom, end of the third millennium, on their journey to the afterlife. Among the over 700 utterances are several dozen spells and curses on snakes that may impede the king's progress. These utterances contain phrases that are reminiscent of the curse on the serpent in Genesis chapter 3. For instance, the biblical statement that the serpent will crawl on your belly is paraphrased.